realm of heaven, the perfect existence that he had with his Father, and entered into a human home, into a human family. And he graced that family with his presence and honored his earthly father and mother. And Luke 2 tells us that he increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and with man. It's the night of December 30, 1862, just outside Murfreesboro in central Tennessee. And after a day spent skirmishing and maneuvering and preparing position, 83,000 soldiers of the two great armies of the American Civil War are settling in for an uneasy night. It's barely 2,000 feet that separate the lines of the Confederate and Federal armies this cold, damp winter night. And every soldier on that field knows that as the sun goes down on the 30th, that when it rises again, he will be part of a death struggle. So as the dread deepens, the various military bands of the two armies try to lift the mood by playing their favorite tunes. And soon a musical battle ensues between the bands of the two armies. The Union and the Confederate bands try to outdo each other. Confederate's Bonnie Blue Flag is answered with Hail Columbia. Yankee Doodle echoes Dixie. But eventually the lively patriotic tunes fade away as one of the bands begins to play the haunting strains of Home Sweet Home. Mid pleasures and palaces though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. A charm from the skies seems to hallow us there, which seek through the world is ne'er met elsewhere. And that tune breaks the North-South competition. And the bands of both armies and the mournful voices of thousands of soldiers join in the chorus. Home, home, sweet, sweet home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. Home is a word that arouses deep and fundamental emotions that are tied to our core needs as humans. It's tied to our comfort. It's tied to our security. It's tied to our belonging and our refuge. It's associated with family and with memories and with a sense of identity as humans. In fact, the word home rouses such strong emotional responses that some Union armies in the Civil War banned the singing of Home Sweet Home out of fear that it was going to cause soldiers to desert the army and go home. Home, or family, is the bedrock of society, and God designed it perfectly from the beginning. Genesis 2:24, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. But as everything that God does perfectly, Satan attacks it immediately. And so very soon after creation, Adam and Eve got into the blame game. And then Cain slew his brother Abel. And it's not long until Lamech had multiple wives, and it went downhill from there. And today, certainly, the home is under attack in society. 23% of the children in the United States live in a single-parent home with no other adult in the picture. About the same number, or roughly one-fourth of U.S. children live without a father in their home. But it's not just out there. It comes pretty close home, because between 20 and 25% of Christian marriages end in divorce. And so is it any wonder that we're alarmed to see this rising tide of confusion and misery and debauchery and atheism? But it comes even closer home, because as we endeavor to build our homes among this wreckage, we're not immune to the influence. And sometimes we have a vision problem called astigmatism. If you have astigmatism with your natural eye, you know that it's an irregularly shaped cornea or clear part of your eye, and it actually distorts the light, and so straight lines look bowed or curved. And so lenses, special lenses are ground to correct that and bring things back into straight lines. And that's the way it can be with our home goals. Our home goals can become distorted by the pressure that is on us from society. And if our lenses become distorted by the world's values, what is straight, according to the Word of God, starts to look bowed. And what is bowed and out of plumb with the Word of God can be made to look straight. Well, thankfully, God has not left us to blunder through life, through home life, without His guidance. And so His Word outlines principles for the Christian home. And I believe that every happy Christian home will be applying the principles of the Word of God and growing in these areas. The title of the message this morning is Seven Pillars of Godly Home Life. And my burden is to, by reviewing these scriptural principles for our home, that we can correct and make sure that our vision is aligned with these goals and renew our goals for our homes. I don't have an animal picture this morning, but I do have a chart. Seven pillars of godly home life or godly homes. And I want to make it clear up front, it comes with a little disclaimer this morning. And that disclaimer is that Joy and I are in the midst of home life. And I do not stand here this morning in any way trying to portray that I've achieved, that we've achieved. But rather, I join you this morning in this effort to build godly home life and hope that we can be inspired together. First part of the message, I'd like to look briefly at some foundational concepts. You could call these the prerequisites for home life, the essentials, the irreducible minimums, the non-negotiables. And the first foundational concept is simply that God's eternal truth is the foundation for the Christian home, and Christ is the crowning head. And Christ not only is the crowning head, but He must permeate every chink of the architecture between the head and the foundation. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Psalm 127, verse 1. The second foundational concept is that one man of God and one woman of God enter an indissolvable threefold relationship with the Lord. A threefold cord is not quickly broken, Ecclesiastes 4:12 tells us. And you'll recognize the triangle of man, woman, and God, or Christ. The triangle is the strongest geometric shape. That's why you see it in building trusses. And that's why you brace X braces across a rectangular structure to give it extra stability. The third foundational concept is that children lent by God to such a union enter the most secure environment possible in this earth. And that is just as God intended. Father, mother, and God form a secure environment for children. They should know where their boundaries are. There should be peace and quietness. I love the verses in Isaiah 32. And the work of righteousness shall be peace. And the effect of righteousness, quiet and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation and in sure dwellings and in quiet resting places. And I know that that's referring to broader than the Christian home, but I think that starts with the Christian home. And God has set up these principles. He's designed marriage. He's designed the family. And He expects us to build on the foundation of His eternal truth and erect the pillars of our home on that and strengthen and support them on that foundation. So the second part of the message, I'd like to look at these seven pillars of godly home life. The first pillar of godly home life is devotion. Devotion is simply religious fervor or piety, an act of prayer or private worship. And when we use the plural, devotions, we're referring specifically to a religious exercise or practice other than regular corporate worship. Religion starts at home. It must start at home, and it continues at church. It's not something that we put on at church or put on in public that's not already present at home. That's a facade. There are several components of devotion that must be present in our homes, and the first is prayer and Bible reading. Acts 10 tells us that Cornelius was a devout man and one that feared God with all his house and gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. That's devotion. And so I urge us as young couples or at any point in home life to establish a house of prayer, regular prayer, family devotions. And there are various ways it can be done. Some find it easier in the morning, some find it easier in the evening. But however it works, do it. It is essential. It's okay for your children to see you having your personal devotions. And a challenge for myself that I'll pass on to you, I wonder sometimes, do my children see me with my Bible as much as they see me with my phone? Prayer. The songwriter says that prayer is the Christian's vital breath, the Christian's native air. And so we must exercise the breath of prayer, exercise breathing in prayer and breathing out prayer. Prayer should be our go-to response to any perplexity, to any trouble, and to any joy. Blessed is the home where the parent prays with the child for things as simple as a lost kitten, as frightening as a thunderstorm. Blessed is the home where the parent prays with the child before or after discipline, or both. Blessed is the home where children, maybe of their own volition, maybe with their parents, pause and breathe a prayer when an ambulance goes down the road for whoever is affected and needs help. We should pray for each other, spouses praying for their spouse, parents praying for their children in their presence, children praying for their parents. It's one of the greatest blessings in the world to hear your children pray for you when they know that you are facing something in your life. Another part of devotion, the pillar of devotion, is God awareness. Did you notice on the chart, or think about, that while it is physically possible for a couple to grow closer to each other without growing closer to God, it is physically impossible for them to grow closer to God without growing closer to each other. And so as we grow closer to God, we grow closer to each other, and it also brings in the walls of that triangle and makes the children more secure. And so our homes should cultivate an atmosphere of reverence for God. Reverence for God and recognition of God leads us to the fear of God. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And I'm not talking about a fear and trembling, although that may be part of it. But I'm talking about seeing God and acknowledging God and recognizing God. You see him in nature and you see him in math and you see him in every turn of life. You see him around every corner. You see him in every valley that you go through. You see him in every bright mountaintop experience and you acknowledge him. I have extremely fond memories of my father, who I'm sure could have used the sleep, going with me in the middle of the night. We lived at a place that had a tremendous amount of light pollution, and so he would take me over back roads to a place where it was dark enough that I could see the meteor showers, and I could see the eclipses, and he fostered in me a God awareness. And if you are excited about God, and you are looking for God, and you are recognizing God, your family will catch it too. Another one of those communicable things that's just all right to catch. The second pillar of a godly home is commitment. Commitment, first of all, to Jesus Christ as the supreme head of the home. But there's a commitment to truth. Deuteronomy 6:8, these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on the gates. The commitment to truth starts with mom and dad, and then is taught to the children. And so the children should know that this home is founded on Bible truth, and if the Bible says do it, we do it. And if the Bible says don't do it, we don't do it. And we're not looking for loopholes. It goes back to what I mentioned last night to the youth about living on the principles of God's word and not just the letter. If we live by the principles of God's word, we will find the principles there to tell us what to do in any circumstance, rather than just looking to see whether it says it in black and white. And I believe as parents, if we fail to teach our children the reason for life and their accountability to God for the life that they have, and our children drift out into the world without the anchor of those fundamental truths, everything else we did for them is a failure in light of eternity. We may have taken care of them physically. We may have left them an enormous inheritance. We may have given them every luxury they could possibly want. We may have left them with a famous name, and it counts as nothing in the light of eternity if the foundation of truth is not there. Another part of commitment is unity. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. A husband and wife find the Lord's fulfilling grace and infilling grace and blessing as they face their struggles and their problems and their questions and their unknowns together. And they formulate their aims for their home together. And this should start in courtship before marriage. But over the years, my heart has gone out to young couples that I see that start out and they are still tied to a parent or their parents' apron strings. And they just have a hard time being their own unit and being unified and building life together. Parents must be loyal to each other. There's this almost blood sport in society today where dad rolls his eyes about mom and mom rolls her eyes about dad. We can have fun with each other, but be careful. Parents must discipline together and give or deny permission together. Children should not know that they can always go to dad and get a yes on a certain question, or they can go to mom and get a yes on a certain question. It's sort of a joke at our house when something comes up. The children know that if they ask dad, he's going to say, well, I'll talk to mom. And if they ask mom, she'll say, I'll talk to dad. I cringe when I hear another man denigrate or criticize his wife. It erodes the pillar of commitment. The story is told that Winston Churchill was at a banquet in London toward the end of his life. And at this banquet, the guests were asked the question, if you could not be who you are, who would you like to be? And everyone was sitting on the edge of their chairs waiting to see who Winston Churchill, the prime minister, the wartime hero of England, would want to be if he couldn't be Winston Churchill. And when it was his turn to answer, he rose to his feet and he said, if I could not be who I am, I would most like to be, and he paused and took his wife's hand, Mrs. Churchill's second husband. Now, Churchill was not endorsing multiple marriages or unbiblical marriages, but what he was saying was, if I had it to do all over, I'd make the same choice. That's commitment. Parents should be loyal to their children, and children should be loyal to their parents. And part of that is simply keeping confidences and being discreet. Another part of commitment is fidelity. Marriage is honorable in all, in the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. Hebrews 13:4. The moral standard of society is determined by what society regards as marriage and home life fidelity. And so if God's laws of marriage and are faithfully applied, it preserves both the purity of the parents and the purity of the children. And let's not ever let the devil deceive us into believing that infidelity in thought or desire is fundamentally different than infidelity in fact. It's the seeds of the same bitter fruit. One man and one woman joined for life, and they become one flesh. And when we enter into that union in the name of God and we recognize His will, we should have the strongest bond possible on earth. And I think we should spend more time solidifying that fact and less time trying to figure out exactly what Jesus meant when he said, save for the coals of fornication. If you go to Mark 10, 2 to 12, you can get yourself twisted in a knot trying to figure out exactly what Jesus meant when he said, there's no divorce save for the coals of fornication. And I have my personal opinions, but remember that the Pharisees came to Jesus and they posed this question to trick him. They posed the question, is it lawful to put away your wife, to try to get him to contradict the Mosaic law so that they could trap him and work against him. And Jesus referred them to the original intent of God. He said, from the beginning it was not so. It was never God's intention for a married couple to part. And I think we do well to just keep that simple teaching as a simple teaching and not look for any loopholes. Settle it in your mind. We work against God if we put a marriage asunder. In God's mind, there is only one thing that dissolves the marriage union on this side of eternity, and that is the death of one of the partners. I've tried to practice it in our marriage, and I urge that any married couple mend any breach of spirit, anything that stands between them before they go to bed at night. Don't put it off. Don't let there be an issue between you when you retire for the night. I found it fascinating to read that in ancient Romania, when a couple decided that they were going to apply for a divorce, the law was that they had to first spend 2 weeks in lockdown in the makeup room of the local church. It was a very small room. It had one bed, one plate, one fork, one spoon, one knife, and one cup, and that was it. The couple was put into the room. They were checked on daily and brought food. But other than that, their 2 weeks gave them time to reevaluate their relationship and communicate without distractions. And the account that I read said that in the 300 years that the lockdown makeup room was utilized, only two couples went through with their divorce in 300 years. The rest all chose to set their differences apart and renew their commitment to each other. The third pillar is the pillar of headship, and I invite you to Ephesians 5. These are very familiar verses, but we do well to keep them as fresh in our minds as the issues are fresh in our lives. Headship. We're familiar with the term. It simply means that everybody finds their own place in the authority structure that God has outlined. Ephesians 5, verses 25 to 29 show us fathers taking spiritual leadership. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth it and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. Any man who has pledged his heart and his hand to a woman owes her his life. He owes her his affection. He owes her his brains, his thoughts. He owes her his hands. He owes her his ears. He owes her his money-making ability. It's a call to die to self, in a small measure at least, the way Christ died for the church. And a man who cannot die to himself for the sake of his wife cannot come close to loving as Christ loved. I believe that spiritual fathers have the greater or the primary responsibility to train and raise the children. And it's a shame if we neglect our family for the sake of work, and even a greater shame if we neglect it for the sake of play. I read a quote this week that you're only young once, but you can be immature indefinitely. And mark it down that if Dad never grows up, his children will have a hard time growing up. We are accountable to lead out, not as lords, but as servants. And I believe that I am accountable for my influence on my wife and my children, and I will someday answer to God for it. In verses 22 to 24, we see mothers giving spiritual submission. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Mothers bring to the headship order prayerful willingness. Someone said that the first home was made when a woman, cradling in her loving arms a baby, crooned a lullaby. And maybe that's where your mind goes when you think of home life, was mother. It said that a mother's work is never done, but the wife is not the slave in the household. Her place in the headship order is not to always give in. Her place is to advise and then submit. Genesis tells us that God said it was not good for Adam to be alone, and he would make a help, comma, meet for him. And that simply means I will make him a helper suitable for him. Not always, when headship order is violated and from afar we look on and say, well, that wife is having trouble submitting in the headship order, not always is it exclusively her fault. In fact, often the faults of one partner are aggravated by the shortcomings of the other. And so, dads, if we are passive, then that fault can be exploited by a frustrated mother who says, here are all the things that my family needs, and Dad is MIA, he is missing in action. Who's going to do them? And she is tempted to step in and take the role that should be ours. Contrarywise, if the husband knows that he is liable to catch it for making a certain decision, do you think he will make it? Or if in the family setting, mom says, well, I think X or Y, but your dad will make the decision. Who made the decision? Go over to chapter 6. Chapter 6, verses 1 to 3 show us the third part of the headship order, and that is children as spiritual disciples. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. One of the worst starts to any life is to be allowed to grow up as a disobedient and rebellious child. Jesus sets the perfect example for all of you children, all of us children. Luke 2 tells us that on the way back from Jerusalem when he was 12 years old, his parents lost track of him and they were frantic. If you've ever lost your child in a crowd, you can relate. When I was little, my parents threatened to put a leash on me because I was prone to just going off and doing my own thing. But when they found him and caught up to him, his mother said, what are you doing, son? Don't you know we're worried sick? And Jesus could have said, oh, here goes mom again. But it doesn't say that. It says that he answered her respectfully, truthfully, and then it says this. He went down with them and was subject unto them. And that literally means he observed their order. And I'd like to just suggest that that means he observed headship order. God had placed him in a physical home, and he honored the order of that home, even though he had greater understanding and greater calling in life than what his physical parents had any concept of. And that is the reason that he increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Submission came first. God uses broken soil as a seedbed for grain. He uses broken grain to make bread. He uses broken bread to feed people. And he uses broken people humbly submitting to each other in home life to support the Christian home. The third pillar is the pillar of nurture. Parenting is an awesome responsibility. When you hold that first child in your arms and you look into its face and you realize the responsibility that is yours, the strongest man and the most stalwart woman should find their strength failing. We have accountability, parents, for how we influence and teach that life that we were instrumental in bringing into this world, but that will never end. Nurture simply means the care for and the encouragement of growth or development of. And my mind always goes to young trees. I love to plant trees and I love to see them grow. But they often don't do well on their own. When a tree is young, it must be fed, it must be mulched, it must be watered. There should be guards around it to keep the animals from nibbling at it. We stake it out, and again, you can go to the analogy of the three stakes that are necessary for a tree to be stable. That work must be done when the tree is young and flexible, because when it gets older and set in its ways, it's almost impossible to correct the bend. When we moved to the place where we live now, there was a pile of logs pushed into the edge of the wood, and when I cleaned up that pile of logs, I discovered that there was a middle-aged tree that had been bent over by that pile. It hasn't straightened up in the last 2 years since it has been freed from the pile. It is bent and probably permanently bent. That's nurture. In a healthy home, a child's best friends are his parents. And we have that opportunity to influence them to start right and help them establish lasting habits before the world has a chance to influence them. And so our homes are training institutes where they learn to work and they learn to sing and they learn to pray and they learn to study, including their Sunday school lessons, and they learn to deny self and they learn to help each other and they learn to give. One component of nurture is love. We're told in Colossians 3:14 that above all these things we are to put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. Love is less about the words we speak and the gifts we give on birthdays and Valentine's Day than it is on the actions that we take every day. And one of the things that distinguished early Christians from their heathen surroundings and the heathen people was the fact that the early Christians took compassion on the abandoned infants. The heathens, when there was a less than perfect infant or there was an old person, abandoned them. They took them outside the city and abandoned them to their fate to die. And the Christians went out and got those infants and they got those elderly and they cared for them. The love was abnormal. It was the love of Christ. And so I believe that our best defense against the enemy is the love that binds us together as family and binds us as a family to God. Love is like a crown. Even a poor man, when he wears a crown, is going to feel like a king. And so as families, both as marriage partners and as parents to children and children to parents, we need a commitment to love in spite of how we might be feeling. I often think about this on a wedding day. A young couple, they can't help but smile, and their face glows, and their eyes sparkle. But it doesn't take very long until they realize that happily ever after only happens in fairy tales, because there are going to be hard things, dark valleys. There are going to be very intense joys. But love is giving all that we have and all that we are in self-sacrifice. Love is not primarily emotional. Love is primarily commitment and secondarily emotion. So it's not about being in love. As Colossians 3:14 says, it's about putting on love. It's about the commitment to love no matter how you feel. Someone has said that the most important thing a man can know is that he approaches his own front door, someone on the other side is listening for the sound of his footsteps. That's love. Another part of nurture is communication. I have a vivid memory of one winter night. I was walking through the snow to do my chores, and I heard a little voice behind me crow, "I'm following you, Daddy." And I turned around, and one of my daughters, about 3 or 4 at the time, was coming along planting her little boots in my boot prints. What a wake-up call. A child's learning process is copying actions and repeating words and mirroring thought patterns, and so more is caught than taught. And as an older parent, I'm realizing that my insults and comments about other drivers don't sound half so macho when they're echoed in the back seat. Children will not respect a parent who says or acts like, "Well, do as I say and not as I do." And so we are communicating, not only by words, but by actions. During the COVID debacle, there was a parent who went in to visit a relative in the hospital and lashed out at the nurses because they would not let him do what he wanted to do. And it really wasn't the nurses' fault. They were just following the protocol that had been given to them. But he made a huge scene. Would you be shocked if I told you that his boys had a very hard time relating to the school teachers? Another father I know of has lost much of his family to the world because he could never conquer his own tobacco habit. He had a lot of good things to say, but his parents saw through the verbal communication to the lifestyle communication. And so what do our children see us doing as parents if we get too much change returned to us at the store? Or what if they're on the small side and we might be able to sneak them into a buffet as younger than what they are? We're communicating. And none of us is perfect, and so one of the biggest things that we communicate is how we respond to our failures and our shortcomings. One pastor told of a time that his father, after there was a period of brief tension in the home, looked across the table at his wife and said, "I'm so sorry I spoke to you that way. I'm ashamed of myself." And the pastor said, "I was not a Christian at that point, but," he said, "after the meal, I went to my room and I knelt and I prayed, 'Oh God, I thank you for a father like that. Make me more like him.'" Was Dad perfect? No. But Dad was willing to apologize. Part of this communication is not relegating to babysitters or phones or other types of entertainment. If we just hand our children off to somebody else to raise, then we shouldn't be surprised if they start to act like that person or that device. Deuteronomy 8:9 makes it very clear, "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shall talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." And you can't teach unless you spend time with them. And it's a challenge. I'm not standing here saying I have it figured out. Isaiah 28:10 has the same idea. Precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. Indicates a walking together. And so our daily conversation should trend toward helping our children with their spiritual welfare, and should open opportunities to talk about the deep spiritual questions of life, discuss values of life. I believe that home should be a safe place for children to express their struggles and their innermost thoughts, but they should always be guided and brought back to the Philippians 4:8 standard of whatsoever things are true, honest, just, pure. They should be safe, though, to say what's on their heart. And then you as parents have the opportunity to redirect that. "Well, now you know how it feels, and you know better than to act that way." Or, "It doesn't matter if everybody else is doing it. It doesn't make it right." And let's be careful in that communication not to turn them into victims. I believe a sizable part of communication involves listening. Even children that are old enough to be semi-independent want their parents to listen to them and to communicate with them. I have fond memories of coming home from youth events, and my parents were often still up, and we just talked. We just check in. Not criticism, not irritability, not inconsistency, but gratitude and appreciation and support for your children and unconditional love for them. I have to wonder how many children lose heart because dad had a hard day. Malachi 4:6, I think, shows us the heart of God when it says, "He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers." Another part of communication is discipline. And let's be careful. The purpose of discipline is to disciple them. The root word of disciple and the root word of discipline are the same. We are to disciple them. We are to show them the way. It's not simply a matter of lashing out and punishing them. It must never be done in anger. It must always be done in love. The spirit of discipline must be, "I love you too much to let you get by with this." I heard years ago of a girl who bragged to her classmates, "Mom never spanks me." It wasn't but a couple months until she told her classmates, "Stupid mom." Do you see a connection between the two? Did mom really love her? One time a young fellow asked me, "Well, how much of your child training should be love and how much of it should be discipline? Should it be 50-50 or 30-70 or 60-40? You remember what I said the first night about God and his attributes? He's 100% love and 100% justice and 100% everything else. And so I looked at that young man and I told my wife later, I'm sure the Lord put it in my mind because I hadn't premeditated it. I said, "It's 100% love and it's 100% discipline. There's no pie to divide up. It's got to be 100% of each because that's the way God is." And so our children should know that we would run in front of a bus to save them. But there are non-negotiable lines that they dare not cross. "He that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes." And discipline is a tremendous opportunity for communication and teaching. But I believe that a greater part of discipline is actually spending time with the children and discipling them, demonstrating and gently correcting to show them good manners and loving kindness and being helpful and how to treat animals and how to treat siblings. Think of the difference between Absalom, when it says in 1 Kings 1:6, "And his father David had not displeased him at any time, saying, 'Why hast thou done so?'" And you know the story of Absalom. Versus Genesis 18:19, where God said of Abraham, "For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, that they shall keep the way of the Lord." The fifth pillar is brotherhood. Church engagement. I encourage each of us to support our local congregation as much as possible. Our children will sense our priorities. My wife and I were both blessed to grow up in homes that made it a priority to be at church when the doors were open for services. And so I was flabbergasted a few years ago to hear of a young teen who didn't even realize that there was Bible school at his home congregation. He knew where his parents' priorities were. So church engagement is part of brotherhood. Another part of brotherhood is accountability. We should be glad for the brotherhood's role in keeping our families on track because we all have blind spots and flat spots that we can hardly see on our own. And our children will be confused and disillusioned if their parents appear right on Sunday but live the way they please through the week. And don't be surprised if they apply that same standard to home rules. We are simply a link in the chain of faith. 100 years from now, no one's going to remember you. But if you are a faithful link in the chain, you link the generation who handed the truth to you to the generation to whom you hand the truth, and you are faithful as that link in the generation, your life, however humble it is, can bear eternal fruit in your descendants. Sometimes we talk about a generation gap, and it's easy to blame the generation gap on the old and say, well, they're just old fogies that don't know how to connect with the young people. Or we blame it on the young people and say, well, the young people just don't have any respect. I'd submit to you this morning that we middle-aged people have more responsibility in the generation gap than either of the two generations flanking us, because we are the ones that need to bring the two together. And so I urge you to teach and demonstrate and require respect and love for your elders and your parents. I've heard students over the years that had nothing good to say about Grandpa because Dad had nothing good to say about Grandpa. And the fruit is now being born when they don't have anything good to say about Dad. The sixth pillar is vigilance. History records the destruction of an ancient town. The watchmen of the town were very diligent. They were very vigilant, and when they saw anything suspicious, they would call it out. And the townspeople grew to resent it because there were a lot of false alarms. And they pushed back at the watchmen and said, you're frowsing us out of bed for no reason. And so the watchman said, well, fine, we'll just keep quiet. And when the enemy came, the city that should have been easily defended was reduced to smoking ruins. And years later, someone erected a memorial where that town once stood, and the memorial simply said, here stood a town destroyed by silence. Well, our families have that same sad epitaph. Dads and moms, the church cannot and does not want to legislate every issue. Do you want the Encyclopedia Britannica for your decrees? And so I simply urge us that many of the battles will be won or lost in the home. Life is real, life is earnest. Let's renew our vision. Let's sharpen our vision. Let's apply the principles. Ezekiel says that if the watchmen see the sword come and blow not the trumpet and the people be not warned and someone dies, he will be taken in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hands. And that's sobering as a parent, because we are watchmen for our families. And so if we tend to think that we can be the exception to the rule, we'll end up proving it. There are external enemies. We may ban worldly music, but fail to instill an appetite for solid church music, and contemporary music will fill the gap. And so I urge us to supply good quality music and good books and teach our children to sing. I find that my music tastes were set when I was very young, and although I went on a journey, I ended up circling back to the roots of what I was taught very young. We can reject the radio and the television, but carry in our pockets a much more powerful device that can be a hybrid of the two and beyond. And I'm not saying, again, that I haven't figured out. It's something that I'm wrestling with. But think about it and make sure that you are vigilant about it in your family. Can we dress out of standard because it's more comfortable and convenient and then expect that our children won't take that clandestine dress as their new minimum standard? Think about it. There are internal enemies. We appreciate our Anabaptist culture, but it's not going to protect our children from their own carnal nature and their own heart weakness. And so do we relax when we've boarded up our homes and kept society out, but fail to monitor our children's activities and influences among their friends? There are many children that were unsupervised as children. There were many adults who were unsupervised as children who wish that their parents had kept better tabs on them and kept them from curiosity going rogue. There are some activities that simply pose unacceptable risk to our children, and we need to be brave enough to simply say quietly, no. And all other activities should be like Ronald Reagan said about the Soviets and denuclearization: trust but verify. If we vigorously defend our distinctive Anabaptist culture, but we never teach the conviction and the obedience to the biblical principles in which they're based, we'll lose them. God calls his people peculiar. If you were here last night, you heard the definition for peculiar, but I'll give it again in the context of family. Titus 2:14 says that we are a peculiar people, and it simply means owned, belonging to someone exclusively or especially. And so I ask, are our families secure in their exclusive ownership by God, even if it makes them look peculiar to the world? Casual Christianity does not build strong godly homes. And so what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. The last pillar is the pillar of service. The story of Jesus in Mark 6 has challenged me recently. It's the story where, right after John the Baptist was killed, Jesus said, "Come ye apart into a desert place and rest a while," because there was so much coming and going that they didn't even have time to eat. And so he put them on a ship and sent them to a desert place by ship privately. But the people saw them going, and the people went ahead of them around the lake and were there when they disembarked from the ship. And what did Jesus say? "You've crossed my boundary. This is my boundary. Nope, go away. I don't have any time for you because I have this plan. I need some self time. I need some self-care." How much me time did Jesus have? Here's what it says that Jesus did. "And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things." Be very careful with the concept of boundaries, that I cannot serve because I have this conception of what I need. I know there are limits, but hospitality can be practiced and balanced with family life. And I would just encourage us to be careful with the idea that dad needs to go on a guy's trip and mom needs to go on a girl's trip at the exclusion of families. It may be appropriate at times, but be careful. Well, a minister from the 18th century told the story of two paddle boats, steam paddle boats, that left Memphis, Tennessee around the same time, headed down the Mississippi River to New Orleans. And as they ran close to each other, they started to exchange taunts between the two crews. The next thing you know, they were challenging each other to a race, and the race began. And the competition was cutthroat. It was vicious as they roared through the deep south, belching smoke and flames. And one of the boats started to fall behind. You see, they'd taken on plenty of coal for the trip, but not for a race. They were running out of fuel and started to drop back and lose the race. As the other boat taunted them, one of the crew members got a brilliant idea. He said, "I wonder what would happen if we started throwing the cargo into the ovens." And he discovered that the furniture and the cargo burned just as well as the coal. And the boat was back in the race. And the crew got busy fueling the boat with all the material that they had been assigned to transport. And they won the race, but they lost their cargo. I leave each of us with the challenge that God has entrusted very precious cargo to our homes, our spouses, our children, our families. And our primary job is to see that this cargo reaches its destination safely. And yet there are so many distractions and so many worldly goals and so many ambitions that can take priority over our cargo. And I challenge myself and I challenge you, will we sacrifice souls to achieve some worldly ambition? None of us this morning here is perfect. I don't think there'd be one person that would be brave enough to stand this morning and say, "I've got this all figured out." And so we press on. And God give us the wisdom and strength to build our homes on the foundation of his eternal truth and to raise our families to his honor and glory. Let's kneel for prayer.